Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam.
So are you finished with all your holiday planning? We didn't think so. So on this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley has some tips on getting ready for holiday traveling, mailing, shopping, and more. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And as always, Kevin will also have information and advice on personal finance issues and answers to your questions at 1-800-642-1234. So if you have a personal finance question, call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us today in our Madison studios. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So there is a quirk in this year's calendar, meaning that there's going to be fewer days between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So we should get planning on our holiday-related activities sooner rather than later.
I've had several people who can stand listening to the show tell me, Joy, that one of the reasons that they hesitate when listening is they hear a lot of things where they say, oh, geez, that's another thing I have to worry about now. And this is our duty, is to lead with something that it's a polite reminder that due to the calendar, there are actually only four full calendar weeks left after this one before December 25th. And in due to demand and the efficiency of the various providers who want to take your money, you better start now when it comes to your travel plans or what you are going to be mailing or toward your holiday shopping.
Yeah, so I am not planning any big trips over the holidays, but what should we know about traveling?
Well, first of all, don't expect to get any bargains, especially if you wait a long time. Prices and demand are up. Christmas travel will be up about 8% in 2013 over the numbers in 2012, according to the good people at the Airlines Reporting Corporation, and they ought to know. They're unlikely to fall into the end of the year, and especially if you are planning on flying over the holidays, don't fly Sundays after the holidays. And the really great way to get good bargains and still get a good seat is to fly actually on the holiday instead. The 25th, 31st are all good days to fly compared to the other days. You're definitely going to want to check sites like Kayak and expertflyer.com to see when seats open up on particular flights. In terms of the hotels, you want to book now, and especially if you can book a room that is refundable, because you can book now, make sure you get the room, and then you can watch some sites that we're going to mention later on in the show, and use those sites to see if the price has actually gone down after you booked it, and then you can cancel it and rebook again if you want. And even if you're driving, now is the time to get a tune-up on your vehicle and then pack it with an emergency kit like blankets, food, water, etc. Make sure that's all good to go when you're good to go. And then finally, keep in mind, Skype is a beautiful and inexpensive way to spend some quality virtual time with friends and family members, save a lot of money for it. And then you could tell them, you know what, we'd love to see you in person, but we're going to do it when it's not so busy, it's not so expensive, and maybe the weather is a little more conducive to travel.
Yeah, that sounds good. So what about sending cards and packages?
Well, there's only one weekday after December 20th and before December 24th. The U.S. Postal Service says you got to mail your items by the 14th to make sure they get there by the 25th. They say that 420 million packages will be sent this year. That's a 12% increase over last year. And if you don't have to wait in line, remember FedEx, U.S. Postal Service, and UPS all have pickup that you can order a package to be picked up at around a certain time. So if you don't like the waiting in lines and try to mail it, have them come to your place of work or your home and pick up the package for you. And then stamps.com has a really neat feature, and I think Zazzle.com does this too. We'll put these websites up at onyourmoney.com. But you can actually take a photo and make it the stamp for your holiday mailing cards if you'd like, as long as you're comfortable with your friends and loved ones seeing your face is canceled by the Postal Service. You can just use it as legal. You can finally be on a stamp, Joy. Maybe that's what I'll do for my stamps this year. I'll put you on one.
Thank you. So you can create your own stamp. And I want to throw you, Kevin, either, but I thought I read a story, too, that Amazon has teamed up with the U.S. Postal Service, and there will be Sunday delivery.
I think that's in limited markets, but right. I think by next year at this time, it'll probably be in almost all markets. But I think New York and Los Angeles are the only places that might be available for Sunday delivery right now via Amazon.
So what about shopping?
Ah, yes, can't forget about the shopping. You definitely cannot wait for bargains at the end of the holiday shopping season. Retailers are already trying to get a jump on sales. Early openings for Black Friday and Thanksgiving Day shopping are starting on Wednesday and even Thursday in some major retailers. And even if you say, well, I'm going to shop online on Cyber Monday or whatever that is, those are starting earlier and earlier. And because of the mail schedule, getting a package that you purchase shipped either to you or to someplace else could be very difficult getting it there in time, especially on the hot gift items. And later on in the show, we're going to talk about a strategy you can use for buying your gift now and paying for it later.
Did you buy your Thanksgiving turkey yet, Kevin?
I have one of these things, Joy, that I got a long time ago that has really helped out with efficiency and especially around the holidays. It's called a wife, and I would recommend you get one, too.
Well, my husband will do this.
All right, good. Well, that's a spouse anyway. So, yeah, Rachel's in charge of those things this year.
In any case, the Wisconsin Farm Bureau did issue a price report on the traditional Thanksgiving meal, and this year for a typical dinner for 10, that's a pretty
wow.
hefty size, but the cost would be $48.40. That's 50 cents cheaper than last year. So the traditional Thanksgiving Day meal, according to the Wisconsin Farm Bureau, is going to be 50 cents cheaper than last year. The turkey is actually cheaper, but you'll be paying slightly more for some items like milk and rolls and peas. And, you know, I say just don't buy the peas.
Don't buy the peas or charge admission. That's another thing. $12 a head, you can make a profit. Have you ever made a meal of this size in your past?
I only bring Brussels sprouts to my sister's house. That's all I
do. Oh, and the kids love it. Oh, good. Aunt Joy's here with the Brussels sprouts.
Exactly.
I smell Brussels sprouts. It must be Aunt Joy.
And that's hilarious. They probably really do laugh about it. Actually, I have my niece and my nephew asked for it last year. So.
Can I give you a little tip to you and everyone else?
They're lying.
The Brussels sprouts aficionados.
What?
Roast them.
That's right.
Anyone will eat
do.
Brussels sprouts if they're roasted.
All right. Well, maybe you can give us a Thanksgiving meal tip when you call in, or if you have a question for Kevin, you can have that too at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Bob in Brookfield wants to know, please ask Kevin to explain the IRS tax brackets and how they work. If your income takes you into a higher tax bracket, does that mean that all of your income is subject to the higher bracket?
Well, it is a very important distinction. I'm glad Bob and Brookfield asked. Was there false praise in there?
There was none.
There was a polite request. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's important not only for your own personal planning, but also as in regards to tax policy, monitoring how tax rates are set, and around the holidays, arguing with your relatives about whether or not their taxes are too high. These are progressive tax brackets, which means the first batch of income is taxed at either nothing or a very low rate. And then as your taxable income rises, so does the actual rate over a certain level. But to answer your question specifically, Bob, it is only income above a certain mm-hmm. level that is taxed at that specific rate. The higher you go, not only is the higher the rate is, but also you have the potential to lose some deductions along the way.
All right. Can you tell us how that might work for the average or middle income taxpayer?
Sure. If we say, let's say it's someone who has a $60,000 gross income, let's say they're married, filing jointly, they've got a couple kids under 18, they're taking a mortgage deduction for the interest, and they're also paying property taxes. Well, in terms of their federal tax bill, the first income up to $17,850 will be taxed at a rate of 10%. And then that income above that level to $72,500 will be taxed at 15%. Anything over that, if they were to make some extra money, would be taxed at 25% and beyond. But now their effective tax bill, according to TaxCaster at H&R Block, would be $1,956. So on $60,000 of gross income, the effective tax rate is only about 3% of their gross income.
So do these people, they usually don't earn enough to lose out on the deductions and credits, though, isn't that right?
That's right. That usually kicks in at a much higher level, usually around $300,000 to $400,000 of gross. Let's say you had a couple in the same situation, but they had, let's say you had $350,000 of gross income. Well, then their top income tax rate would be 33%, and then they'd have some extra surtaxes on for Medicare and on investment income. So their effective federal income tax bill would be $85,000 on that $350,000. Again, their effective tax rate, while they'd be in the 33% bracket, the effective tax rate is 24% of their overall gross income. Still high, but not to the level that a lot of people would think for an income that high. And then plus they probably have some deductions phased out, such as certain charitable deductions, et cetera, could be phased out, and they could lose out on those to some extent.
So how many taxpayers do you guess are in those higher brackets?
Well, as a percentage, it's not many. The one percenters right now of income tax filers on a federal basis, it's at about $400,000. And as 1%, that's still 1.3 million filers. So it's not many in percentage, but it is a lot in terms of number.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for him, a money matter, a personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our first caller is Nancy, who is in Michigan's beautiful Upper Peninsula. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. Good morning. I really don't have a question. I just have a comment regarding our two beautiful little granddaughters who are spoiled rotten. They have every toy imaginable. They have every gadget possible. They have enough clothes to probably house a bunch of other children. But we decided this year that the only thing left to give them is a college education and lots of love. So what we've done for our two grandchildren is set up a college fund through the Michigan Education Savings Plan. And it's really a great way of getting your shopping done early and providing for the children's college education. They're only 3 and 5. And so this money will continue to compound over and over again as they get ready to go to college. And anyone can contribute. Family members, we've already sent out invitations to family members saying, don't know what to go, put money into their account.
Well, that's very nice of you. What a nice grandma, Nancy. But they're going to want the Xbox or something, aren't they?
Sooner or later. And Nancy, I'm no pediatrician, but what as a parent, I've noted that what you actually hope for your young grandchildren is eventually they grow enough to outgrow those clothes. So sooner or later, you will probably, unless it's all like, you know, stretch pants and snuggies and snuggles or whatever. Yeah, that's a great idea. For the good people of Wisconsin and other states, check your own state's plan at collegesavings.org or savingforcollege.com. Usually you can get some in-state tax deduction. We're actually going to talk about Wisconsin's EdVest plan and these other 529 accounts. But yes, it is a very nice gesture. And you're right, Nancy, long after those toys are thrown away and the clothes are outgrown, they will be very happy that their grandma and grandpa set some money aside for college.
Thanks very much, Nancy, for the call. Coming up on Your Money a little bit later, we will shop around for holiday presents on layaway. We'll talk more about that coming up as On Your Money continues here on the Ideas Network.
Gotta get me some dollars and cents, dollars and cents. Them greenback bills with the pictures of the president.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. Welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tina in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Tina.
Good morning. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for all your wise advice, first of all. My question is, I have my oldest daughter will be going to college next year. So in January, I've been listening and you say that start the financial aid in January. My question is there a way on the site or the website that you go to to estimate your taxes because we won't have a tax bill right away in January.
Sure. And and thank you for the false praise. And, and she delineated between all the advice I give
and your wise
and
advice.
Just the wise advice. She's only appreciative of the wise advice, and rightfully so. Tina, you are wise in yourself to be filing this financial aid form, first of all, but to be doing it. Second of all, to be doing it as soon as possible, because some need, depending on the institution and type of aid, some of that aid is awarded on a first-come, first-served basis. And so usually families who have a student attending higher education institutions in the fall, for instance, in this case, the fall of 2014, should file as soon after January 2nd in 2014 as they possibly can. But as you astutely pointed out, Tina, you will not even know what you're going to pay in taxes, much less have your 1040s filed. But the good people at the FAFSA.ed.gov, FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A dot ed.gov are the ones who run the government-sponsored federal financial aid form, and they will allow you to use estimates. So put in your best guesses, and you may want to base it on last year's taxes, your 2012 returns, and then you can go back in and later on in March or April, whenever you get your taxes done, you can go back in and fill in the actual numbers, but at least this will give them some idea of where you're going to be and your interest in attending a particular school as well.
Okay, and then I have one more question. We do have a 529 plan. Is it better to use that 529 plan that first year? And if it is, or however that works, can she also use that for, like, a laptop for classes if it's required? Is that, like, an expense they would let you use that for?
Generally, it is. The expenses are fairly liberal in terms of what is allowed for a tax-free distribution from a 529 account. However, I recommend that you use the proceeds from the 529 account for the later years in school rather than these years, because I'd like to see people borrow first and use savings last, because if you borrow money now, you know that you can get it, and you know that the interest rate is going to be relatively low. And if there are better loans down the road, you can cash out the 529 accounts and use it for those expenses incurred this year, pay off the loans with a small penalty, or save that money for later on. There's generally no window to which 529 plans have to be cashed out for an individual child. So I'd much rather have you use the 529 later and use, even if you it's tough for you to borrow money and you look at the interest rate, you blanch a little bit, Tina, I would like to see you use the subsidized loans first for any expenses you can cover. And then if you still have expenses above that in a given year, then look at the 529 accounts.
Thanks for the call, Tina. Good luck to you and yours. Keith in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Keith.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello.
I have kind of a unique situation. I'm going to take you off speaker here.
Oh, that's better. Thank you.
Okay, better, okay. I had you on speakerphone. My wife was a teacher for almost 40 years here in Green Bay, and she had retired at the end of the school year and was going on to the emeritus program. The emeritus program is one where when a teacher retires the following year, they work a certain number of days for the district as a sub, and they get their entire last year's salary paid to them in a third over the next 3 years.
Okay.
So that, say, it's $60,000, it's paid out 2020 and 20 in the next 3 years. And that was going to help our retirement. It was going to kind of ease us in. Unfortunately, about 2 weeks after the school year ended, she passed away.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And what happened was is the school district kind of wants to get you off their books when that happens. So they handed me a check for the entire lump sum amount without any taxes taken out. And this is a substantial amount. She'd been, like I said, she'd been a teacher for 40 years. She had a master's plus. So she was at the pretty much at the top of the pay grade. So I have her entire last year's salary plus the emeritus plus my earnings for the last year. And I was wondering, is there any way or what's the best way to try to minimize the taxes on that big lump sum?
And I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your loss, first of all, Keith, and second of all, going through this thing which loved ones go through, common after someone passes away, where after in the midst of grieving or even before the grieving starts, the paperwork begins, mm-hmm. and it's just one extra drag on top of a very unfortunate situation. And all of the income would be for 2013, correct? Okay. Well, the good and the bad news is it's fairly simple. And according to my understanding of your description of the situation, first of all, I really would like you to get a CPA. It's well worth the investment. Might cost you $600 to $800 even, but if you can find one in your area who can take care of all these details, you don't have to worry about it and get stressed out about it. Give that person the situation; they'll be able to clean it up for you and get a real CPA for this particular instance. But it will just be taxable normally as ordinary income for you, unless you can realize losses, make some donations at this time, or are there any kind of pre-tax contributions you can make to retirement plans. There's really nothing much that you can do for it, but because you are probably going to be filing jointly, the tax brackets are double what they would be if you were to be filing on a single basis. So I think even though it probably is a substantial amount of money, first of all, there's not much that you can do about it. Second of all, you have to probably file in regards to an estate. And I think the term that you're going to want to look for is income with respect to a decedent. But again, I would defer to a CPA on that situation.
Our best to you, Keith. Thank you for calling. Larry in Wapaka is with us now. Hello, Larry.
Hello. Thank you. I have a question related to wills and trusts. I currently own my home, and we have a home in northern Wisconsin, two smaller vacant properties. And I have a will, but I guess my question is there a benefit to having a trust versus a will?
Absolutely. Is someone telling you this, Larry, or is this something you're acting on your own volition?
I'm doing this on my own.
Okay. I ask because sometimes there are very good reasons to have a trust. One of the reasons not to do it is because someone is pressuring you into paying them money to set up a trust for you. But most good lawyers will tell you accurately whether or not you need one and whether it's worth it for the expense. The will is a good idea for people with simpler estates and simpler issues at hand and situations. And the trust is one for someone like you. It sounds like it's more expensive. And typically the trust is something that can be administered while you're alive in many cases. You might have a revocable trust set up that if you are alive but not able or interested in handling your affairs, you've already set up not only a vehicle that is owning your affairs, if you will, but also you've hopefully set up a trustee of someone whom you trust now to handle those issues, not only while you're after you're gone, but while you're alive as well. And unless you're going to do something in regards to a revocable or an irrevocable trust, which is more complex and usually used for gifting and estate tax purposes, the revocable trust is fairly simple to not only set up, but also to administer. You oftentimes will use the same tax ID numbers, but it's just a more effective vehicle for it. So in a situation like yours, Larry, I'd recommend that you look at a trust. Again, I'm not a pediatrician, as we established earlier today, and I'm not a lawyer. So I'd like you to contact an attorney. But a trust would be something I would definitely consider in your situation.
Larry, thanks for the call, and good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he is here just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. If you have a question for Kevin, we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for us to get smart, our smart assets segment. And we are spending this time talking about some year-end financial moves that you should consider. And what is that financial move this week, Kevin?
We are going to address one for those who have investments outside of retirement accounts like Roth IRAs, 401ks, IRAs, etc. These would be investments like stocks or mutual funds, and specifically addressing capital gains and capital losses, when and why you should take those gains and losses, and specifically why you might want to do it now and sooner rather than later.
Well, let's start with the gains. What should people do with gains?
Well, first of all, they should try to wait until they have had those gains long enough so that they are designated long-term gains, and those are generally over 1 year since purchase. The rates are very low on long-term capital gains taxation. It's usually zero if you're in the 15% bracket or below, which most middle-income taxpayers are. And even above that, it's only 20% at the federal level in most cases. And you can't get around capital gains. The only way that you can avoid them is if you have some losses to work against them, or you die, or you donate your appreciated assets, which we'll be checking back in on in a couple weeks.
All right. So what about taking losses on investments?
You definitely want to do that now, in part because you can work the losses against any gains that you've already realized this year, or you can use up to $3,000 of losses against your ordinary income. So people who have ordinary income can generally save about $800 to $1,000 in income taxes by realizing up to $3,000 of losses. And then you can carry forward your losses if you don't use up, if they're over that $3,000 amount this year, you can carry forward those losses every single year until they're used up, and again, use them against realized gains to offset the taxation there or against ordinary income.
So whether people are selling their wins or their losses, what are some things to watch out for?
Make sure that you check any commissions and costs to sell before you do it. Know what that cost is going to be versus the benefit. And also make sure that you have the accurate cost basis for the asset. The IRS is starting to get very particular about that, and you'll need that figure when you go to file your taxes on April 15th or October 15th if you get an extension. Watch out if you're buying mutual funds right now, because a lot of mutual funds are distributing their realized gains right now that they've incurred during the year. And if you buy a fund today and they distribute this big gain tomorrow, the value of your account the same, but you still have to pay income or capital gains taxes rather on that distribution. So make sure you know when the funds are going to be distributing those gains and wait till after they've done it. And then make sure you don't, if you sell any assets with a loss, make sure you don't buy it within 30 days prior to the sale or 30 days afterward. Otherwise, you can rebuy it, but don't do it in that 60-day window, because the IRS will then disallow that loss.
1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a question for Kevin McKinley. Kathy emails, how safe is it to buy CDs online from banks listed on Bankrate with 4 or 5 stars, like Barclays? Is it better to buy CDs locally, even if the rate earned is lower, like 1% or less instead of 2% online?
Barclays sounds like a good name for your dog, doesn't
it? It does.
I like that, Barclays.
It sounds like a travel agency, too.
Right. Well, there is some European component to it. How safe is it to buy them online? I think it's pretty safe. Bankrate has a safe and sound rating to which Kathy is referring, and 4 or 5 stars is pretty good. But Bankrate can only go by the public filings that the bank or credit union makes, and so it's difficult to know what's actually going on behind the scenes and how the sausage is being made. But generally, those filings are audited pretty deeply, and so that's a fairly reliable a source of information for it, and they can get as much information as you can. What's more important is to make sure that the CD bought at the bank or the credit union has federal insurance, up to $250,000 per account. Some people like to buy CDs because the rate or because the CD is local. I suppose there's some benefit for that, but in terms of safety, probably not, because it's not like you can march down to the institution, pound on the door, and demand your money if there's a problem. That works in the movies from the 30s, but if something happens where it would trigger that need to do that, you're probably they're going to lock the doors and lock the online access as well. So whether you have it overseas or down the street, it's not going to make much difference.
It's a wonderful life. Is that your experience, Kevin? That
life is wonderful. Yeah,
well,
pretty
too.
Good.
That
Some days better than others, but right.
Well, but that CDs at a, you know, the bank down the street are 1% or less, and if you could buy online, it's 2%?
Typically, some of that is because they're almost like loss leaders. Like the bank is trying to draw funds in from all around the place, and so they're paying a slightly higher interest rate on some CDs. Sometimes the terms of the higher rate CD aren't as good as the ones with a lower rate, so that's definitely something to consider. And finally, some people just like to look a person in the eye when they're dealing with their finances, and they just prefer to be able to walk up to the counter and purchase that. I'm not sure how much longer that feature will be available, but it is right now, and if that's important to you, you might want to stay local.
We have a caller now from Fond du Lac. Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning. What's your question?
I'm wondering if you guys could briefly discuss the pros and cons of a bond ladder versus bond index funds in today's rate environment, given that the Fed is going to ultimately raise the interest rates. I am a smaller investor. I have about $500,000 in bond funds currently.
Well, I don't like those bond ladders at all, Kevin. I'm just kidding.
You fell off one when you were a child. I like how Tom said he'd like a brief discussion. He's like, don't babble on about this. Just give me what.
And he said that we would discuss it, and I'm going to let Kevin tell you the pros and cons.
Thank you. Here's what I like about bond funds. I like it that you can get it access to. There are usually hundreds of different bonds within a fund, and they are generally bought and sold by a manager, even in an index. They're diversified. That you're also probably getting a better price on those bonds purchased within the fund than you would be if you were to go out and buy them on your own, no matter if you went to a full-service advisor or discount broker or whatever. The disadvantage of that of the bond fund versus a bond ladder is with a bond ladder, you own the individual bonds, and for better or for worse, that's what you have. And you know that if you keep the if you keep the bond until maturity, you're going to get your money back at that very time. That's difficult, though, to diversify even a decent-sized portfolio like $500,000. It's difficult to diversify among several different bonds. So I tell you to stick with the bond funds, Tom.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I know me, you better shop around. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it's time for the Shop Around segment. And an old-fashioned way to pay for holiday presents is making a comeback, and it might be right for you. What is this, Kevin?
Well, back when we were kids, Joy, our parents had a choice between paying cash and layaway. And that has actually come back quite strongly with many retailers. It allows you to get an item you want now, not have to use up your credit card limits or your cash. And it's very good for people who are unable to store gifts in a certain place. I have it on good authority that Santa Claus often uses layaway when he can't fit all of his gifts in the workshop.
Right.
Helps you protect against price rises on certain gifts or demand that allows you to not be able to get it and still take advantage of price drops if indeed that does occur.
I do remember that way back when. Here's a coat. I'm going to put this on layaway. And what did you just paid for it at a later time? How does it work now?
Well, the modern version is you do buy the item now, you put it on layaway, and you pick it up and pay for it later when you pick it up, kind of how it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, so that's simple, easy. Is there anything else to it?
Yeah, there are a few things you should watch out for. First of all, many stores have a minimum purchase price that, you know, you can't buy a pack of gum and say, I'll give you 10 cents now and be back later on. Many require a down payment that might be 20 to 30% of it. Others require you to pay cash when you do actually pick it up or pay for the item to put it on layaway. And it is subject to the availability of the merchandise. You can actually, according to some stores' terms, you can actually put something on layaway and they hold it for you virtually, meaning that they know you have a right to it, but it might be held at a distribution center someplace. So you can't plan on just going to the store, picking it up, and going home with it. Make sure you call ahead and say, I'm planning on picking that up on this day. Are you going to have it ready? Some stores may charge some fees for a layaway or a restocking, like it might be $5 or $10 if you cancel it, or they might charge a percentage of it as a penalty for cancellation as well.
So what situations work best for using layaway?
Well, several. As we mentioned, if you're really short on cash right now, you know, there's a billion-dollar payday loan industry that's predicated on people who just have money coming in, but they don't have it right now. So if you're in that case and you want an item, you're going to get a few hours to shop during the week, put it on layaway. Hold it later on. You might not want family members to know about a certain gift that you're purchasing. Sometimes I've had this happen a lot. People want to buy an item. They need to put it on a credit card, but their spouse or partner or someone in the family actually tracks the credit card and says, what's this you bought for $629 from the jewelry store or something? They don't want them to know about it until the gift is actually given. You do want to use it on larger ticket items, though, especially electronics. If you're concerned that the item might sell out, and also you can use it as a hedge. If you think that you might be able to get the item cheaper, check the terms of the layaway plan. Buy it now, put it on layaway, and if it drops down, you may be able to pay a small penalty, but cancel that order and get it again at a much lower price.
Sounds good. So what do you hope is on layaway for you, Kevin? Large electronic item?
I'm a hard person to shop for because I tend to buy things that I want
when I want them.
Yes, life is short. And
that's what I do, right, too. Mm-hmm. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And I'm going to lift the veil a little bit. You might have heard a cough or two or a moment of silence. Kevin has the remnants of a cold. So if you want to give him your cure for coughs, you can do that as well. In case you hear one, that's what's going on.
And I am, just to save some people some time, I am already wearing a hot mustard plaster on my chest. I know,
too.
That's what that smell is.
Right. We have David in Burlington with us. Hi, David.
Hello. I've just got a quick comment and question for you. The comment is, I read somewhere regarding that revocable trust question that if you own real estate outside of the county where you die, that it has to be probated in the county of its location. So a trust is probably a very good idea for that fellow.
Yes, sir, you're correct. And that's the case. And most people do own property. If they do own multiple properties, they're generally, by definition, outside of the area in which they live and may have residency. So you're right. A trust is a much better way to handle that. You still do have to probate it often in the state in which the property is located. But you're right. The trust can help with that.
Yeah, and my question is, I wonder if you could address the interaction of that 529 plan that the lady called about with other college benefits that are available for limited periods of time when the child's in college. And I'll take the question or the answer off the air. Thanks.
Did you get the question?
Sure. It's if you pull distributions out of a 529 plan. Generally, people are worried about if they have money in a 529 plan, it might disqualify them for scholarships, whatever. And that's usually not the case. And oftentimes, if you get a scholarship award, you can pull an equal amount out of the 529 tax-free and use it on whatever you want as long as it matches up to that at the time. Generally, the distributions from the 529, though, do not affect tax benefits used to pay for it, but you often can't pair up tax deductions with the tax-free withdrawal of the 529 and double count the tax credits, if you will.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. We'll go now to Art in Milwaukee. Hello, Art.
Hi. I have a question regarding the marginal tax rate and the taxation of long-term capital gains. So if your total taxable income inches above 15% bracket, does that make all of your capital gains untaxable? And what if most of that income is capital gains itself? Does that count fully towards your taxable income, changing your rate?
Generally, yes. Depends on the situation and depends on where your capital gains fit into your overall income for it. And Art, I'd highly recommend, we'll put this link up at onyourmoney.com later on today, but that H&R Block tax caster that I mentioned, I don't have any tie to them or relation to them, but I just like using it because it's a really elegant way to kind of figure out your taxes. And I'd recommend you do this if you're worried about going into the upper tax brackets. You can use this tool to explain your situation and then put in a number that is, you know, your estimated realized capital gains, and that will tell you not only if the capital gains are taxable, but at what rate those gains will be taxed and what how it will affect your overall bill. And again, that's a if you just type a TaxCaster into Google, you should be able to go right to the site, and you don't have to enter into any information. It's free. It's just a little service they put together. And it may not be H&R Block. It might be Intuit, but either way, it's TaxCaster.
Okay, Eric?
Yeah, you said it was TurboTax last week.
It's one of those. I'm sure it's TaxCaster. That's all I know,
okay.
Certainly.
Perfect. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for the call. We do have an open line for you. If you have a question for Kevin about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Sam in Waukesha. Hi, Sam.
Hi. I am wondering about how much I should be looking to spend on a car. My current car has about 250,000 miles, and I'm looking to get one next summer, possibly. I make about $35,000 a year, but I get laid off in the winter. How much should I be looking to spend on a new car?
Are you a lifeguard by any chance, Sam?
I am not.
You are not. Okay. I'm just curious as to why you got laid off every winter.
Well, maybe it's construction-type work or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good.
I work in a street service.
Okay, great.
I want to ask you, though, Sam, what kind of car do you have that got 250,000 miles?
I've got a 2000 Nissan Altima, and it's been great. It's just getting old. I haven't had any major repairs to do on it yet, which is really lucky.
Yep, I like that attitude of saying I'm going to get out while mm-hmm. the getting's good and sell it sooner rather than later. If it were up to me, I'd actually have you buy a newer car on which you could get a loan. And the reason being is that you're in a fairly unpredictable situation for income, in that you have some really good income at some point, but you have no income at other points. And I'd hate you still need to drive around even when you don't have that income. I'd like you to find actually a reliable car, Sam, that might cost you a little more and you need to buy it with a loan. But then you have a predictable car cost, if you will, or more predictable than if you buy a car with 200,000 miles on it. And this way, I'd like to see you probably spend about to the point where 10% of your income maybe is probably a fair limit on car costs in your situation. So something that keeps you with a payment and insurance of close to $350 per month, somewhere around that range. And that'll generally get you a car with a 5-year loan, 4-year loan. You're probably looking at something in the $15,000 range. And there are a lot of really nice cars that you can find with 100,000 miles. You know, even most people lean towards Hondas, Toyotas, Subarus, et cetera, and think they're very reliable. A lot of domestic companies produce cars now that are much more reliable than they were 10 or 15 years ago. So something in that $15,000 range is probably a pretty fair estimation depending on the rest of your situation.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Sam. My husband just replaced his exhaust system on his 2000 CRV, and boy, that was a shocker.
Was it worth more than the CRV?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. But you know, he wasn't ready to buy a new car on the spot. It was one of those, you
sure.
know, he's ready to do it soon, but didn't want to be rushed into picking the first thing off the lot. So in any case, the guy said that the thing has probably another 100,000 miles on it, though, too, so we'll see. Warren in La Crescent is with us. Hi, Warren.
Hello. I'm wondering, thanks for taking my call, and I love your show, Joanne, Kevin.
Thank you, Warren.
The question is purchasing a mutual fund now and regarding the distributions, wouldn't it be wise to get them within an IRA or a Roth? The distribution, from what I understand, is just extra money from the fund.
You're very astute, Warren. That's correct. If you are going to buy a fund right now, you need to get into it, and you are worried about those distributions. If it is in an IRA or a Roth IRA, and for that matter, a variable annuity, there will be no effect on your taxation when you take that distribution. A lot of people have said to me, you know, I want to hang on to this because it's going to get a distribution coming up, and I really like that. It might feel good, but it doesn't change the it doesn't change the net value of the account. If a mutual fund, say, makes a distribution of 10 cents a share, the share price drops by 10 cents on that very same day. So it doesn't change. You know, it's like cutting a large pizza into 8 slices versus 6 slices. It's still the same amount of pizza, and you're correct. Buying it in a tax-deferred account will avoid the problem of taxable distributions.
Thanks, Warren, for the call. Scott in Highland is with us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question pertaining to financial aid. Before I ask it, I have something I learned that the other listeners might find useful. And that is, if you have high school kids that are going to be going off to college, and when your oldest, for example, is a junior, begins her junior year in high school, the following year is the base income year for your first year financial aid. Anything you can do to increase your deductions, and I wish I were known this, but for example, the spring of their junior year, if you defer your property taxes into the following year, that helps your base income year.
Defer the property taxes into the following year. You mean because you'd be taking the deductions in the base income year for financial aid, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep. That's a very good point, Scott. And anything, and that especially pertains to contributions to pre-tax retirement accounts like your 401k. You should contribute as much as you can to the 401k before your kid goes to college, because you'll probably need that money to help the kid afford college costs. But making the contributions to those at-work retirement plans does not work at reducing your income for financial aid.
And your question, Scott? Right.
My question is, so my situation is, I have a stepdaughter that's going to be going to college next year, and my wife and I will be custodial parents. Her grandparents, her father's parents, put aside money for her for college, and the money is in hers and her father's names. And so I suspect on the FAFSA that is going to show up as an asset under her name, and I was just wondering if there's anything I can do to move that around to a more useful place,
Is it in her and her father's name as like an UTMA account where it's her social security number, but it's in the father's title? He's kind of owning the account right now.
I'm not sure of the details. What I've been told is it's in both of their names.
Okay, I'm guessing it's what I said. And if it is, you want to spend that money as quickly as you possibly can, because that can get hit. Up to 50% of that can get hit a third of that each year can be taken on the expected family contribution. So you want to spend that money down quickly if you think she would otherwise qualify for need-based financial aid.
Thanks very much, Scott, for the call. John emails, I love your show and I always listen, but I'm at work. Busted, and I can't talk. I'm 66, still working, and have applied for Social Security. I have a child who is a freshman in high school, a fortunate oops, and as a part of the Social Security, he receives a monthly stipend, which he will get for the next 4 years. I hope that this will cover a good deal of his college costs. How do you suggest I invest these funds to maximize the growth?
Well, I would invest that money not to maximize the growth. I would want to keep it around, because trying to maximize growth when asset prices are at an all-time high and it's likely you're going to need that money in the next 3 or 4 years, there's not much growth out there. I would just put it in a nice savings account. And if that's the only money you have coming in, you want to concentrate more on getting on your return of your principal rather than the return on your principal.
Thanks for the email, John. Hope you don't get in trouble. So we have time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, it's a special travel holiday triple website of the week. AutoSlash for your rental cars, Tingo for getting hotel rooms, and Yapta for all of your other travel needs. We'll put these websites up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Well, you don't have to give us your destination or anything, but you're off next week. Are you doing some traveling?
I'm just doing some working and holiday shopping. That's what I'll be doing.
Get some holiday shopping in. Okay, good. Time for four more words then before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us just about every week at this time with information and advice on your money. And he will not be with us next week, but the week after that, we'll get more information and advice on your money. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Marika Saval for producing and directing this show. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.